Time now for another of our Strong Women Conversations. John Bauer talks with Kathleen Blake.
Parents aren't supposed to outlive their children. Nobody knows this better than Kathleen Blake. She has lost two children to cancer. Most recently, her daughter Jessica. Before that, her son Michael.
Well, Michael was our youngest son. He was diagnosed with leukemia when he was 3 weeks short of his fourth birthday. I was knocked off my feet, certainly. I think sometimes I would say about Michael that I was in some ways fortunate that all those people died, because I knew about if-onlys, and I didn't want to live with if-onlys. And there was a part of me that knew from the very beginning that he was going to die, even though there was another part of me that did not want to believe that and wanted to believe that he would get well. We took him down to the U of M. His blood count had spiked, and they said it was like a 70%. I don't remember the percents, but I remember saying to the doctor, 70%, they told us in Grand Rapids it would be 85. And she said to me, 70%, 85%, it doesn't really matter. Our goal is to get Michael into the 100%. Michael lived for 5 years. I don't remember all the details of the chemo, but we were there, you know, getting chemo every day and radiation. And so when we brought Michael down, he was so sick and in so much pain, because when you have leukemia, you often have bone pain. And that's because the cancer is in your bone marrow. And so it's just filling up the bone marrow and pressing against the sides of the bone. It's almost like it's trying to break the bone from inside. And so the first few nights that he was there, he didn't fight them. And he even learned to swallow pills. They teach him by giving them M&Ms, which is, like, I think, pretty creative. And so, you know, here he is, and he's not quite four, and he's swallowing pills. The nurses came with his meds and his mouth care. Now, the mouth care is something that they give him because you get mouth sores from the chemo. And I tasted it, and it was disgusting tasting. And so when they came in with that, Michael started to scream. I said to him what I consider my litany. I said, Michael, if I could take your pills and your mouth care and it would make you better, I'd do that 100 times a day. But there was nothing that was going to calm him down. And it was 9 o'clock at night and the other kids were trying to sleep, and I tried to calm him and nothing was working. So I grabbed him under my arm in a football hold and I went marching down the hallway. And the nurses said, Mrs. Blake, can we help you? And I said, no, we're going to scream. And I pointed to the stairway, which, you know, is a big old hospital with big, thick walls. And I set him down halfway between two floors. I said to him, okay, you want to scream? Now scream. And he started yelling, you dummy, you stupid. And, you know, that's not the way he usually talked, but you got to think of the circumstances. And I started my litany again. Michael, if I could take your mouth care. And in the middle of saying that, I remembered something I read in the newspaper in college. And in that newspaper article, they said that when children are sick, they think it's their fault. And so I stopped and I said, Michael, you didn't do anything wrong. That's not why you're here. And he stopped in the middle of his scream and he said, I didn't? And I said, no, honey. And he crawled up into my lap and we snuggled and hugged. And after a while I said, well, you know, honey, you have to go back and do your mouth care. And he said, I know. And I said, is there anything I can do to make it better? And he said, tell me a story. I didn't have a story, so I said, honey, I don't have a story right now, but I promise you in the morning when I come back, I will have a story for you. So we went back, he did his mouth care, got him to sleep, and when I came back in the morning before he started his meds and mouth care, I had a story about Michael Elephant. And Michael Elephant was just like all the other little elephants in Grand Rapids. He liked to ride his bike, play on the swing set, and he liked to play in the sandbox and swim in the lake. And in the winter, he liked to play hockey, and he liked to ride his sled down Murphy Hill as fast as he could. But then one day, something different happened to Michael Elephant. One day, Michael Elephant got sick. And this was not the kind of sickness that he could just go to bed and feel better in the morning. This sickness was so bad that he had to go to a hospital far away. And when he got there, Michael Elephant was sad. And he was lonely, and he was scared. But most of all, he was worried that he did something wrong. And then I would ask him, "Do you think Michael Elephant did something wrong?" And Michael would say no, because we'd already had the conversation. I probably told him that story 150 times at least over the next few years. After he died, I told that story to other little kids in the hospital, and whenever I would say, "Do you think Michael Elephant did something wrong?" they would always say yes.
You just knew in your heart as a mom that he was going to die.
I think because so many people had died in my family, there was a part of me that knew that he was going to die.
Did Michael think he was going to die early on?
Oh, yeah. He had a concept of death, I think, that most children his age would not have. Every night when I would put him to bed, he wanted to talk about Grandma and Grandpa and Uncle Tom and Uncle Mike. I knew that it was about death, but I didn't know what exactly he was asking. So I would talk about them being in heaven and that we will see them after we die. But then maybe 6 months or 9 months after he was diagnosed, we went to see Return of the Jedi. And Michael was sitting on my lap. And in that movie, Yoda dies in his sleep. And Michael sat straight up and he said, "Mom, do people die in their sleep?" And I said, "No, honey. In the first place, if you are going to die, Dad and I will never keep that a secret from you. And secondly, even if for some reason we didn't know, you would know. You will just know." And after that, he could go to sleep at night. Isn't that something?
Sounds like an amazing young boy.
Yeah.
How old did he live to be?
Almost 9. He was 2 months short of his 9th birthday.
What was his physical condition?
I always said when he was well, he was really well. Of course, when he would get the chemo, he'd get sick. So I would farm out my other 3 kids because for part of this time, Rick was away at school in North Dakota. And then I'd drive down to the cities to have his chemo Monday morning. And then I'd drive back and he'd be throwing up all the way. Fortunately, we had an old VW van with a hole in the floor. This was before, like, car seats had to be in the back. So one time he's in the front in the car seat, and I, for whatever reason, I didn't have his barf bucket up there. And he said, "Mom, I'm going to throw up, and I'm in the middle of 3 lanes of freeway traffic in the cities." And I said, "Honey, I can't do anything about it. Just lean over it and throw up on the floor." So he throws up, and then we stop and just take the floor mat and dump it out the hole in the floor. So we did get some kicks out of that fully air-conditioned VW van.
That's Kathleen Blake. You're listening to Strong Women on Northern Community Radio. The news wasn't good. The doctor informed them that Michael had a post-transplant relapse.
Michael crawled on my lap, and Michael said, "That means I'm going to die, doesn't it?" And Michael said, "I'm too young to die. I know I didn't do anything wrong, but it feels like it. I know God loves me, but it doesn't feel like it." When we went in the first time after that, every doctor and every nurse and every lab tech that he saw, he said with a big smile on his face, "I've decided not to have any more treatment." I think it was the first time that he maybe felt some control over what was happening.
What else did he give you that you've carried through for the rest of your life?
He had such an incredible sense of humor. And so I promised myself after he died that I would laugh every day in his honor. No matter how sad I was, every day I would find at least one thing to laugh about.
Are you afraid to die?
I'm shaking my head, no. I was 25 when my dad died, 28 when my brother died. I knew that I had the same skin type as they had. It was obvious to me that there was something genetic, and I just assumed that I would die young. And now with my daughter dying, I'm grateful that I'm almost 70, because I don't have so long to live.
Tell us about Jessica.
So Michael was my youngest. Jessica was my second youngest. Actually, when Jessica was 25, she had a melanoma and a sarcoma at the same time. So we went to Mayo to see a geneticist, and the doctor asked Rick all kinds of questions, and there was just no cancer in his family. And then he asks me, and I start naming my grandpa and my dad and my brother and my son and my dad's sister and one of her children. And, you know, it just went on and on. Then he needed to examine Jessica. We leave the room. We're out in the waiting area, and I'm sobbing. And Rick says, "What's wrong?" And I say, "Well, it came through me. This cancer came through my body." You know, of course, Rick says, "Well, you know, it's not your fault," and all of those things that you can say. But this has nothing to do with the head. This has to do with the heart. But I finally pull myself together, because Jessica's going to come out, and I'm the mom. And I have to be strong, right? She comes out and she says something. I don't remember what. She was pretty discouraged. And I said something to try to encourage her. And Rick says, "Oh, baloney, Jess. Your mom has been out here crying her eyes out because she thinks it's all her fault." And Jessica puts her arm around me and she says, "Oh, Mom, it's not your fault. It's your dad's." So that was very helpful.
It's just interesting how you told Michael it's not his fault, and now you have a daughter telling you, the adult, it's not your fault.
That's interesting. I never thought about that.
Wow. Mm. She gets progressively sick.
It was just a surgical excision of the melanoma and of the sarcoma. I mean, you know, they dig pretty deep, but they were both pretty surface, so that was taken care of. Then another year later, she had some kind of tumor in her abdominal cavity. It was not in any of the organs. It was just in the cavity, and then that had to be removed. And then she had a few good years, and then she had another melanoma, and then a couple years would go by. And so over the years, from 25 to 39, she had some neurofibromas, several more melanomas, but they were always just surface, always just excised. You know, it was like pretty hard for her because it was always popping up and she always had to deal with it. Then when she was 39, teaching at ESCO school, the spring they got new laptops and she was complaining about the brightness of the screen, and nobody else seemed to be having trouble, but you know, they said, "Well, some people do. You need some kind of extra screen to put on there." And all summer, she was saying how tired she was. And I just thought, well, it was a stressful school year. Maybe you're just exhausted. Maybe this is good. Maybe you just need to take it easy. The day before, she had gone into another teacher's room, and the teacher said something about her eyes, because one pupil was dramatically dilated and the other wasn't, and Jessica was saying that she couldn't see very well. So she went to an eye doctor, and he didn't see anything. Then the following day, she was in school, and she said, third period, she just had to tell the kids, "Just take out your books. I'm not feeling real well. Just read. I'm going to go get somebody to come in here." So she went to the pop machine to get some Gatorade. I don't know what happened, if she put in too much money or what, but like the coins were just tumbling out and she was totally confused, kind of fell down onto the ground. Another teacher was going by, saw what was going on and picked her up. And Jessica, he had to help her to the office. She couldn't walk. They immediately transported her in Duluth. And then I knew immediately that she had a brain tumor. Unfortunately, this was a glioblastoma, the same kind of tumor Joe Biden's son died of, John McCain has, Ted Kennedy had. And it just, we knew from the start that that was not curable. Although we always hoped that new research would come along and they would find something that would cure her.
You went through this very same thing with a 4 to 9-year-old. Okay, so you're dealing with these same things now with a 39-year-old. Was there a difference?
Yes, a big difference, because Michael was a child. I mean, he was not quite 4 when he was first diagnosed, and he was not quite 9 when he died. He was dependent on me. And at that age, moms are pretty smart. So I could really feel like I could guide him through this process. With Jessica, she's an adult. And furthermore, the first 9-10 months, because of where the tumor was, and then because of the swelling from the radiation and the chemotherapy, she was not herself. She would wander. She would sometimes say pretty bizarre things. It was like Jessica's body was there, but it was like Jessica wasn't there. So the first 9-10 months, when I look back on it, I feel like I came out of that first year with PTSD. I mean, I just, it was so hard trying to take care of somebody that I knew was going to die that wasn't even there. I remember saying to the doctors, at least with Michael, we had Michael till the last 8 hours of his life. With Jessica, it's like she's not even there. And her doctor said, yeah, that is the cruelty of this kind of cancer. She was really not there until we got her on medical marijuana. She was like, yes, no, I don't know, was basically what kind of communication we could have with her. 2 weeks after we got her on the CBD, which is, for people who don't understand medical marijuana, there's the THC, which, as I always say, is why I smoked it when I was a kid. And then there's the CBD, which is non-intoxicating. The CBD had been shown in animal studies and in some studies in Spain, I believe, to reduce inflammation. The problem was the inflammation around her tumor. 2 weeks after we got her on the pure CBD, she went from yes, no, I don't know, to being able to carry on full conversations, make jokes, get jokes, make her own appointments, keep her own calendar. She was not capable of doing any of those things. So that was amazing. It was like we got Jessica back. For the next couple years, she did pretty well. She always was low energy. And she was a dancer and continued to dance with the community dance troupe just because she enjoyed it so much, and a runner and a very active, physically fit person. The chemo, which she was on continuously, made her so tired. So she was not quite the high energy person that she was not able to go back to teaching until about 2 years after diagnosis, and then went back for half a year. She said it felt so good to be back because the kids gave her energy and they gave her a purpose. She really did love those kids and they loved her.
You had to make promises to Michael. Did you have to make any promises to her?
What I had to promise Jessica was that I would keep going, that I would be okay, and that we would all be okay, that we were going to miss her terribly, but that we'd be okay, and that she should not worry about that.
How do you keep going?
Well, I cry a lot. I think if I didn't cry, then it just would build up in me, and I would be bitter and angry. And that doesn't mean that sometimes I'm not bitter and angry, because sometimes I am. But I talk with people. I have another mom who has a son who died of the same illness, and she and I get together and talk. I talk with a therapist, because this is too big to do alone. I scream and yell sometimes. I'm grateful for a wonderful group of women who are really strong women in this community that support me. I'm grateful for all of my friends who support me. I don't know what I'm going to do now. I've always been sort of driven to do something that makes a difference in this world, and I don't know what that's going to be right now. And I'm kind of waiting for the next inspiration, I guess.
Do you have any parental guilt?
Yes. So some of my guilt is because she still could understand. She understood everything that we were saying, but she couldn't tell us what she wanted, what she needed. And so we did get really good at playing 20 questions. I was really grateful that I had spent so much time over the last 3.5 years with her, because I knew her well enough to know a lot of what her wishes would be. But I look back now and I think, someday she must have been so bored. Why didn't I do more of this or more of that? And, you know, I had to call my sister the other day and say, Mary Pat, tell me again how loving I was. She would watch me with Jessica and she would say, you are so loving. And so I need to be reminded of that. But one example is every night before she'd go to bed, she had these creams that she would put on her face, and I would wash her face with warm water and put the wash rag there and just let it sit because that feels good. And then I would put the lotions on. And the last night before she died, I was so tired. And by that time, she was like on her side. We had to keep her on her side because she couldn't swallow. You know, and I would only be washing one side of her face, and I was so tired. And so, you know, I feel guilty about that, which is dumb, because, of course, she would not want me to feel that. But it was like one of those loving things I could do would be to put that cream on and say, oh, your face feels so soft.
Thank you.
Yeah.